Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Indian Religions, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, I have two lovely guests today. We have Dr. Uta Huskin, who's professor and head of the Department of Cultural and Religious History of South Asia at Heidelberg University, and also Dr. Astrid Zotter, who's researcher at Heidelberg Academy of Sciences and Humanities. These are two of the three editors. The third is Vasudha Narayana. We will have her in a subsequent podcast, but these are two of three editors of a really rich, fascinating, brand new publication, Nine Nights of Power, SUNY 2021. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. So, Nine Nights of Power, Durga Dolls and Darbars. Someone tell us, how did this come into being? You know, what's the story behind this publication?
Do you want to take
that? Yeah, I can start. Well, basically, it's one of the two books which are the outcome of an international collaborative research group on Navaratri and Durga Puja. The first one you have already covered in your podcast, Raj. I think Caleb has spoken about the first volume, which is Nine Nights of the Goddess, the Navaratri festival in South Asia. And this also had appeared in at SUNY as our book, which is Nine Nights of Power, Durga Dolls and Darbars. And we've been meeting a number of times in different places. I think our first meeting was in Paris, then we met in Austin, then we met in San Antonio. We also had a panel in Erfurt and maybe even more. I don't really remember every detail, but we met in different constellations, but we always talked about Navaratri of Durga Puja, and especially of its different aspects and different local manifestations. And so this book is, as the first book, one of the outcomes of our collaborative effort.
It really is a far-reaching and important group that you've amassed. I had the good fortune of participating, being part of it. I was very excited to speak with so many scholars about Indian goddess traditions. And clearly the work has continued very richly. Do you want to say a little bit about the volume, perhaps how it's structured?
Yeah, maybe the volume, so to say, is a direct continuation of this first volume, which was, I mean, even the title announced it. So from Nine Nights of the Goddess, we go on with Nine Nights of Power, focusing on the different powers the festival has. So something like, we look at what work does the festival do, what does it achieve, and our focus is on agency on the one hand. So what does the festival do? So we adopt the concept of agency, which is a bit strange to people that we speak of the agency of a festival, but we conceived the agency and festivals as a distributed among different agents. And so the festival actually has or develops its own power. And we look at the festival in its different dimensions, how the power unfolds, so to say. And this is also the structure of the book. And I think what is also a special point in that volume, as compared to the first volume, is maybe the stress on visual material. So we not only look at the performative aspects more closely and the agency and the authority structures, but also provide the reader with visual material. So we have, thanks to sponsorship by two academic institutions, the Oslo Institute and the Heidelberg Academy, we were able to print the volume with color plates. And we conceived these picture images not only as, so to say, illustrations, but also as a potential way of knowing and the potential way of conveying our arguments. And this, I think, is also special about the book.
It is a notable feature. There are beautiful, engaging, colorful images that each have so much to say in addition to what the papers about them are saying. And for anybody who's had a taste or an experience of the festival, it's so rich. And so I'm glad that the images were included. Do we want to talk about the different sections of the book, perhaps? How the book is structured?
Yeah, maybe the structure is, in general, we have three different sections. So maybe as not every reader has the book at his or her desk, we just go about the sections one by one. So the first will be Navaratri as agent of renewal and transformation. The second is propriety versus creativity in Navaratri. The third one is gendered identities in Navaratri. And the last is Navaratri as instrument of power. And maybe we can just go through the papers one by one, if you like.
Yeah, that would make sense. Say, you know, the title, the author, a word or two, yeah, what it's about. And then afterwards, we could talk about the diverse array and who might be interested. But yes, that would be a great next step.
Okay. So the first paper is by Hilary Rodriguez. And the title is Ritual of Revitalization, the Transformative Power of the Durga Puja. Hilary's paper is focuses on Benares, where he did field work in the 1990s. So he is one of the, I think, one of the pioneers of the field. And his book on Durga Puja in Benares has maybe inspired all of us to this work. And so to put his paper first is maybe also, so to say, is dueful. He focuses on the Durga Puja's power to transform and to revitalize and distinguishes three different levels. So the communal, the personal, and the cosmic level. And he argues that in each of these levels, the rituals of Durga Puja transform, so to say, the performers, but also the spectators alike. So on the communal level, we have the social bonding, which happens in neighborhood levels, in the organizing committees, in the families, and we have the whole redistribution of wealth during the festival. Then we have the personal level, where the worshipper is empowered and transformed, where boons from the goddess are, so to say, granted to individual worshippers. And then we have the cosmic level, which also, so that the Durga Puja also transforms the whole cosmos and is connected to fertility and sees the earth as a mother. So we have on the one hand a festival which is deeply entrenched in the social, but at the same time, it also transcends it and, so to say, roots it in both worlds. So on the one hand, we have the whole social dimension. On the other, we have this permanent binding to the cosmos and to the transcendent world. Yeah, this is maybe this what Hillary's paper is about. The next paper would be by Nilima Shuklabat, Straddling the Sacred and the Secular, Presence and Absence of the Goddess in Contemporary Garbo, the Navaratri Dance of Gujarat. This is a very interesting piece, and we were very lucky and happy to have Nilima on board, because in the beginning she wasn't so much part of that group, but she came in, and I think this is one of the most interesting papers because it focuses on a Navarata celebration or Durga Puja celebration not very well known, at least in academic circles, the Garbo dance of Gujarat. It may not be well known to us, but I think in India it's all about
very well known.
And very well known, and the people engage in it, but it hasn't received so much scholarly attention so far. And that's why it's very good to have her on board, because she shows what happens to such a ritual when it is, so to say, propelled or transformed from a local neighborhood affair to being a super popular, mass spectacular with many people involved. So originally, so to say, in the traditional way, it was just a neighborhood affair during the Durga Puja, autumnal Navaratra. The women came out from the house and danced around a small pot representing the goddess and singing songs. And this, these performances were then already in the 19th century, they were often taken up by, so to say, people who had a social agenda or political agenda and invested with new meanings. And then over the last, I guess, 10 years or so, they became multimedia spectacles and events known to the whole youth of modern India. And the dancing itself became the major point. And she looks at what this, so to say, secularization of the thing does to the Garbo dance, also arguing that the, so to say, desacralization, as one may call it, also can be seen as a kind of secularization, because at the same time, a religious event is brought to the, so to say, popular stage, which I think is a very nice and nice argument and makes one think about, so to say, modern and popular Hindu religion in India.
It's fascinating. The last podcast that we did actually was on a monograph called Devotional Hindu Dance that we covered on the podcast. And it was a call to a return to the sacrality of Hindu dance. So there's some really fascinating work in that article. And it's really important considering how popular this phenomenon is and how little has been written on it. So those two papers, just to attune the listener, belong to the first section of the book called Navaratri as Agent of Renewal and Transformation. And now we're going to take a look at the two papers in the second section of the book, Propriety versus Creativity in Navaratri.
Yeah, I can take over here. The second, as you rightly say, the second section deals with propriety and creativity, but also its limits during Navaratri. And we have two contributions. One is by Mumita Sen, who is from Oslo University, a different university in Oslo, and myself. And Mumita writes, the title of her presentation is "Can Didi Truly Become Durga? The Riddle of the Two Goddesses." And what she's talking about is largely the political aspects and political dynamics of the Durga Puja in Kolkata. So she's introducing the political scene, but also introducing how these pandals, this kind of makeshift temples that are set up each year during the Durga Puja in Kolkata, and which makes Durga Puja, I think, worldwide so famous, how these are on the one hand themed and artistic, but how they also are highly political. And her example are those pandals which actually have Mamata Banerjee as deity, so being displayed, displayed as Durga, and how her, let's say, political foes are then also displayed as asuras. But this is not uncontested, and it's also, it's highly problematic, of course, to have a living human being being represented and as Durga. And then she also, Mumita also talks about this, the actual ritual that is being performed during these Durga Pujas, and that these big Durgas are not necessarily, or in most cases, not the target of the ritual actions of the priests who do the puja, the daily puja, but rather a small statue of Durga, which is at the site. So she's talking about these contestations, which are going on not only during Durga Puja, but also before and after it. So this is a very highly interesting piece that also lets us think about other settings where the political aspects of this festival are not so evident as it is in this case. Then the second contribution to this setting is actually myself. So at least I can confidently talk about what I at least wanted to say. And this is entitled "Limits of Creativity, Kolu in Brahmin Vaishnava Households in Kanchipuram." And what I'm talking about is, in general, Kolu. Kolu is these domestic setup in South Indian, mostly Brahmin households, where dolls are placed on these different stages, and these dolls represent deities. They represent, but also, let's say, village scenes, or they represent, their kind of, might also be kind of zoos or other so-called, I mean, what we would see as secular dolls that are placed there. And what I am looking at here is one specific kolu, and that is actually a kolu which is set up by a good friend of mine every year, who is, in contrast to the usual kolu hosts, is not a woman but a man, and who also does something very special. He makes the dolls themselves, and these dolls are special in so far as they are made of waste material. And so that means, and he's basically continuing a tradition that is has been started by his mother, who made golu dolls from discarded clothes and wire. And he's making life-size golu dolls. And these life-size, I would say, statues basically also represent the deity Varadaraja, who is in the temple just across the street. And I'm talking about the success and sometimes also the failure of this specific setup, which results from the discrepancy between the materials, the waste material, and the displaying a deity with waste material. So that is my contribution. And then there's the next section, which of the book, which talks about gendered identities in Navaratri. And we have in this section, we have three contributions. And one of them, actually the first one, is dealing with masculinity and Navaratri. I mean, in general, we often hear that not only is Durga Puja Navaratri the festival of the goddess, but also a woman's festival. And in many ways, that is true in many places. But it's not just that. And that is what I think makes this contribution so valuable and outstanding. So and this is by Jeremy Saul, and Jeremy talks about ascetics or young men who emulate Hanuman follow ascetic vows and also dress up as Hanuman and who celebrate Navaratri in that way. So he's talking about what this means to their identity, how this intersects with, I would say, like sports events, but also how this is kind of, that's his argument, restoring their own Hindu masculinity and how it becomes so popular and widespread in that way. And let me just, so the location of this is Salazar, and there's another location that I actually have forgotten. Panipat, yes. And there he's looking at two different traditions which both place Hanuman at the center rather than Durga, which is extremely interesting, I think, for a festival that is called Durga Puja.
I have to say, I found that contribution particularly fascinating. In a very rich book, it really stands out. It's something I think it's important to study because it's just so it's challenging to make sense of, yet there's so much there to make sense of. So I'm really glad you were able to include that. I hadn't heard of that. I mean, I know of some wisdom teachings where Durga is associated with Hanuman for practice reasons, but I had never seen any of this phenomenon or come across it before. So it's really fascinating.
Yes, and I not only in terms of material, but in terms of topic, because we have been grappling with this throughout the project duration. The question of how does Durga Puja relate to Ram Lila, or do they relate to each other? Are they in competition with each other? How do they complement each other? And how do people basically understand the relation of these two? Because Ram Lila, of course, also there's a lot of masculinity going on there, and it's taking place. So that is maybe also a topic that might be taken up in future research, even more pronouncedly, the question of the complementarity or maybe competition of these two celebrations during Navaratri.
And also when thinking about gender studies, we are used to thinking about femininity and females, and to have the other perspective to focus on masculinity. I think this is a newly rising field, but an interesting one.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So I find I've often noted, at least in the depiction of the Devi Mahatmya that I mostly study, I've noted that Durga very much in the Devi Mahatmya is very motherly, very martial, very feminine, very masculine in different ways. And there's this, there are these interesting threads there. So listen, if there are grad students out there who are looking for a project to research on, this might be for you. what's the next paper about?
The next paper is by Jennifer Ortegren. And it's entitled Going Home for Navaratri, Negotiating Caste, Class, and Gender Between Rural and Urban Rajasthan. And Jennifer takes a very specific approach because she's following two individuals, two young girls who oscillate between their, let's say, urban home and then visit for Navaratri, however, visit the family home in the village, and how they navigate these very different identities, and how that also, on the one hand, of course, it restricts them much more than they the rural setting restricts them on the one hand much more than the urban setting, but on the other hand also allows them much more freedom in terms of, let's say, playing out their female identity and so on. So that is a very special contribution, especially since it looks at individual experience of Navaratri. And I do think that this is, when we look at festival studies in general, this is an important aspect that needs to feed into all other aspects that we might want to research when we look at festivals. So individual experience, which is very, of course, very limited, as our own experience, of course, always is. We always stand in one corner and a lot of other stuff is going on in another corner. we have no idea of that. But that is, I think, a very valuable contribution in that, but also in very many other aspects, because also here, the questions of different caste identities, and not only gender identities, but also caste identities are addressed and analyzed by Jennifer. So, yeah. The next contribution is by Ina Ilkamer. Ina Ilkamer has again worked on Tamil Nadu, and her contribution is entitled Female Agency During Tamil Navaratri. And so she's looking at different aspects of the festival as it is celebrated in Kanchipuram, where she did her fieldwork, and talks about the question of how is Navaratri actually celebrated in homes, but also how Navaratri, and especially the domestic celebration of Navaratri in homes by women, is also adopted by by other than Brahmin castes, and how that then again changes the celebration itself. That, for example, in some kolus that are celebrated in non-Brahmin homes, also the goddess is fed meat and alcohol, because that's what she's demanding, something unthinkable in let's say, Brahmin homes in Kanchipuram. But she has also one very, very outstanding example of one woman that she encountered, and she's become friends with, is in Kanchipuram, who not only celebrates Navaratri and Kolu in an extremely grand way, but who also, and in whose celebration, this is also combined with a procession. So the goddess takes possession of this woman, and then neighbors and other, let's say, clients or followers of this woman are coming and seeking the advice of this, of the goddess through her, which I find is a very interesting example how the adoption of these, let's say, performative tradition or the ritual traditions can also change what is actually going on, but which also shows how there is a very individual appropriation of this agency and how this woman becomes a very specific and very, very powerful agent in this celebration, as she can even be compared to a priest in a temple. So yeah, so there's a lot of material in this contribution, but and very much that most people will never have heard about.
It's so fascinating. It reminds me of a little snippet. I happened to do some advanced Sanskrit training in 2012 in Pune with the American Institute of Indian Studies program. And there was this, she was from a particular Brahmanical Vaishnava lineage, and for some reason they decided to do a Chandi Homam, a fire sacrifice to the Chandi, where the Devi Mahatmya is liturgically intoned. Many of you in the audience are maybe familiar with that. And although there wasn't a particular connection to that deity, one of her aunts was possessed during the ritual. And during that time, they venerated her as a Murti of the Devi. And it was so atypical for their family and their dynamic. And yet it was something that was just accepted and unspoken about, that this is the play of the Devi. So much interesting material in those three articles in the gendered identities in the Navaratri section. And now we turn to the fourth and final section of the book, Navaratri as Instrument of Power.
Yeah, this is a section which covers, so to say, more traditional topics on Navaratra. So Navaratra in the royal courts, so celebrated by those who were traditionally charged with the protection of people and country. And two papers are about kings or royals that are not in power anymore. And the first one is about the Nepalese case, which is my own piece. It is called Who Kills the Buffalo? Authority and Agency in the Ritual Logistic of the Nepalese Dasain Festival. So I look at the, so to say, logistics of the buffalo sacrifices in Nepal. And I do that on the basis of historical documents from the long 19th century, so starting in the late 18th century and throughout the whole of 19th century, and ask myself, as we often read about Nepalese sacrifice, that there are so many buffaloes killed. And my question was, where do all these animals come from? And if we look into the papers that the state issued, it seems that the three, so to say, things, the procurement, the killing, and the after use, they had very different, arguments to convey about the society. So in procuring the buffaloes, the whole realm, so to say, of the king, every village had to contribute a buffalo to a temple. And you had to commit yourself materially to the state to show that you are Nepalese. And the people remain unnamed, and they are just, so to say, the subjects of the king. When it comes to the killing of the animals, the the result is, or the it is different, because the only ones who could kill the buffaloes in the sacrifices were the royals or the kshatriyas, who were, so to say, constructed as the apex of the social pyramid, and they so to say staged masculine devotion and devotional killing in these sacrificial arenas as a, so to say, prime worship or devotional act, so to say, as a devotion to the goddess. And if we then look into what happened to the buffaloes afterwards, we see that they are distributed not to those who killed them, but to because the consumption of buffalo meat was a no-go in traditional Nepal. So the buffalo is an impure animal, and whoever eats it is considered a low caste. So these killed buffaloes were distributed among people who, so to say, enshrined their lower casteness by accepting that meat. So we see that the whole logistics of the buffalo conveys particular statements about how the state is, or a Hindu state is organized in Hindu or royal Nepal. But what we also see, and this we only see after, so to say, arrival of democracy, and also in some earlier period, that these so to say state arguments are also challenged by different groups, because Nepal is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious state. And of course, these sacrifices were appropriated in different settings. So by either turning these arguments around, or by just celebrating the things differently. And this is what I tried to look at. So the competition, the state, so to say, the statements made by the state by dealing with the buffalo, and then also the arguments against it that were brought forth by other groups on the ground. If we look at this contestation of arguments on of traditional narratives about Navaratra, these issues also play a role in the other two papers in that section. So we have Caleb Simmons' paper, Domains of Dashara, Reflections on the Struggle for Significance in Contemporary Mysore. So he looks at the Mysore celebrations and shows how in traditional Mysore and also in modern Mysore, these celebrations become a ground for struggling about a significance. He starts from the historical perspective, so focusing on the period when the king was still in power, and then goes on to contrast that historical perspective with the modern perspective, so showing how the Navaratra or the Dashara celebrations are held nowadays. And he argues that on the one hand, we have the traditional, so to say, performative and ritual rhetoric that the goddess and the king are equated with one another, and this couple of goddess and king produces the power that is then distributed in the whole polity. And if we now look at the modern celebration, something very different happens when new political powers come in. So the old Raja and the old power is, so to say, pushed aside a bit, and new political actors take their place. And we have this constant struggling for power and for powerful places in front of the goddess and around the goddess, and the struggle for carving out significance of such rituals. So we see that throughout the history of that ritual and of Navaratri rituals in general, there's constantly this making and remaking of meaningfulness and also of trying to channel the power of the goddess for one's own ends. And this is, I think, beautifully illustrated by Caleb's papers. And in a similar vein, Uwe Skoda's paper writes about such power struggles and such struggles for milking the power of the goddess. In his paper, The Ups and Down of Competing Power Rituals, Dasara and Durga Puja in a Former Princely State of Odisha, he looks at the Navaratra celebration in a princely state in Odisha, in Bonai. And he looks at what happens to these celebrations. So there are, three different actors involved. We have the traditional celebration by the king, and then we have a new actors coming in. So we have more Bengali style market Durga Puja, and then we have another RSS Durga Puja being celebrated, and these struggle for significance but also compete over space.
Fascinating, far-reaching papers. Just a couple thoughts. I know we need to close soon to take care of some commitments. So then, who was this book for? Who would be interested in this book? What kinds of fields or studies or approaches?
Well, I would say I was myself surprised, but basically what I think it is an excellent book for teaching on Hindu studies. So it's not necessarily, I mean, you of course you can teach about Navaratri, but what is I think much more important here is that you can teach through this book about different aspects of different Hindu traditions. And it's kind of epitomizes different aspects that you might want to focus on. You expose your students to. So in that sense, I think it's a perfect book, as is the first book, for students of Hinduism in the a very general sense. But it's at the same time, interestingly, it's also a extremely good book for specialists if you're looking into goddess traditions, if you're looking into Hindu festival traditions, if you want to look at Hindu traditions through local aspects of these traditions. I think at least I use it a lot in my teaching, much more than I would have thought before we actually came up with these volumes.
I couldn't agree more. Just by chance, this podcast is taking place a couple of days after an AAR meeting. There's a Navaratri group there. There'll be another a panel next year as well. And the topic was teaching. Using this for teaching, and I had the pleasure of moderating the discussion, and so much came out of that in terms of ways in which to use this to convey the breadth and depth of Indic traditions to undergrad students. So I couldn't agree more. Was there anything else on the book that you wanted to touch on before we close? No, you're good. Okay, so for those of you listening, we've been speaking to Dr. Ute Huskin of Heidelberg University, and also Dr. Astrid Zotter of the Heidelberg Academy of Sciences and Humanities. We've been speaking about their brand new Sunni publication, Nine Nights of Power, Durga Dolls and Darbars. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating the Nine Nights of Power. Take care.